that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Welcome to Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimbaugh. This is the Cricket Podcast, where we answer questions that, I was going to say, the cricket world wants to know, but the sick people like us within the cricket world want to know. Normal people don't care about Wagon Wheel questions at all, I'm sure. They just go on with their lives. Poor bastards. If you want to ask questions, if you're watching live with the YouTube, the best way is via Super Chat. And if you can't do that, and because it's random where we actually end up doing our episodes, and you just want to record normally, ask questions at your own pace, then Patreon is the way to go. So Jared Kimbaugh, oh my god, I do that every week, patreon.com/Jared Kimbaugh will get you there. There's different membership tiers available. We've got Discord community, all these different things, but that's the best place to go if you want to ask questions like James has. Did Australia's modern era start with 1987 World Cup, 1989 Ashes, or the 1995 Frank Worrell Trophy? I think the most important thing to look at there is the fact that, like, the 1980 beating England in England in 1989, by that stage, other teams had beaten England, right? Like, so New Zealand had beaten England, and West Indies obviously were dominating them. I'd have to go back and have a look at Pakistan, but they weren't considered, you know, it wasn't considered a huge thing. It was a big thing for Australia because they've been playing poorly for a little while, but it wasn't, you know, potentially the biggest deal in the world, I don't think, around that particular time all that much. If you look at Australia's record, 1987, they win the World Cup, as you point out. That was on the back of losing to England in Australia. They lost to Pakistan in Pakistan. They lost to the West Indies at home, beat England in the Ashes, drew with New Zealand, but I think that was like a one test or something silly. And then they lost to New Zealand in 89-90. So you can see there, you know, plus they were still losing to the West Indies. Whereas if you go from really 1992 onwards, where they draw New Zealand at the start of 1992. So when they go to England in 93, so basically Warne is where it starts, I suppose, is the best way of looking at it. So Warne starts to play, and by 1993, Warne's kind of a star, and Australia then lose 1, 2, 3, 4 series until 2005. So if you really want to go back, that's probably the period. So it's that partnering of, it's really Warne, and then obviously once Warne and McGrath come together, that is taken to a whole different level. But 95 is kind of when we think of as them taking over the reins, because that was when they went to the West Indies and won. Whereas the series before, when they played the West Indies, what was that, 91, 92 or 90, 91? Where is it? Yeah, 90, 91. 92, 93 is the last time. So the West Indies are in Australia there, and they lose the first couple of tests. Where are we here? So first test is drawn. Then Australia win at Melbourne. That's when Shane Warne comes out. And then the West Indies win the Adelaide test by a run. Fantastic test match. Australia bowled out for 184 at the end. And then goes to the Wacker and the West Indies smash them. So it's right after then that it all kind of comes together. And it really is, you know, 95 is really McGrath, but they didn't need McGrath in 93. Their bowling attack was fantastic there. Rudra says, among cricketers who've been retired from internationals for at least 10 years, who would be the best at playing T20 cricket now at their current ages? I don't know. It's probably someone who was really, really good who retired at 22 and we don't know. I'm trying to think of someone. So they've been retired for at least 10 years. I mean, the trick with that, Rudra, is I'd have to remember when people retired. And in the last 10 years, people have retired in so many staggers that it's been almost impossible. It probably would have been Andrew Simons for a while that would have been that player. But obviously, he's passed away. Ian Harvey would probably still be a handful, I would have thought, slogging and you know, still bowling slower balls that would give people problems. Klusner. Probably a little bit older, although he might be about the same age as Harvey. Yeah, that's a really tough one just because, like, you'd have to factor in the actual ages. And it's probably, though, someone who retired just a little bit too early, if you're really being honest, and continue to, you know, at least from the top level and continue to play. Trying to think of someone who might have retired from international cricket. And there might even be someone who retired from international cricket and still playing franchise cricket. Is Mitch McClanahan still technically around? Although he wouldn't have. When would he have retired from international cricket? Or did he retire from international cricket? Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer that one. Because it says, why Rishabh Pant gave an over to MRs against CSK and gave away 14 runs when you have six bowlers and they're bowling good? I can understand if you want to give a sixth bowler, but not a seventh bowler. I mean, that Delhi CSK, who is the bowler you're talking about here? Mitchell Marsh. Well, Mitchell Marsh took the most wickets that they had last year, right? So they still think of him. I think they believe in Mitch Marsh a lot more than perhaps I do. Perhaps you do as well, Vickers. If you don't think your sixth bowler is weak, which clearly they don't, although he has been struggling this year with the ball, Mitch Marsh. If you don't think your bowler is weak, then it's worth using a sixth bowler for one over because it gives you flexibility with everyone else. And when you say something like, well, everyone else is bowling good, but what if you've got two overs left of, I'm trying to think. Well, it gave them flexibility. So you look at their lineup and they had, oh my God, how many bowls did they use? So they used seven bowlers. But Rakesh Salem bowled two overs for 25, right? And it gave them flexibility with Ishant Sharma, with Akshar Patel, with Mukesh Kumar, just, you know, and they were. That's probably what they were looking for, just more flexibility. Teams like that, right? And there are other sides who are just like, we've got five bowlers, we're using the five bowlers until they go out. That's just, it just depends on the captain, really. And the game situation sometimes. What's the best way for RCB to use Green's bowling with his development in mind? With his development in mind, if you're an Australian fan, you probably want him to be used as one of the five bowlers. That would be the best thing if you're an Australian. If you're Cricket Australia, they might be like, how many overs is he bowling over there? Do we really want him to bowl that many overs? So they might think of these things a little bit differently. I think he just needs to bowl as much. He's probably going to be a middle overs bowler would be my guess. But the best situation for Australia would be, or for Green, would be that RCB try him everywhere. Try him in the power play, they try him in the middle, and they try him at the death. And, work out if he's got a good position. You know, you look at someone like Ben Stokes, who just didn't really ever have a great position in white ball bowling. I reckon had he been used more with the new ball up front, the way he swung it, it might have been his best spot, but he didn't really get, you know, didn't play in teams that allowed him to do that. And because of that, he never really developed that skill the way that I think he probably could have. And that's kind of, he never had another great skill in white ball cricket when it came to bowling. He's below par bowler, and he shouldn't have been, right? So I think if you've got a player like Cameron Green, what you really want them to do is find the method. You know, is it slower balls in the middle? Is it bouncers in the middle? Is it, Yorkers at the death? Is it hard length at the death? Is it back of a length early on and hoping that people, or maybe even a good length early on and trying to force people to go back over his head and hit the ball straight up in the air? He has to work out what, he only needs to be a plus in one of those areas, and it's huge for the rest of his career. If he's not, then he's a slight negative all the way through, and he's a really good bat who you can give the ball to more in emergency or on bad days. Adityan says, what is Zahir Khan's legacy in T20 cricket? He was the first one I remember relying almost solely on slower ones in the death, albeit in the 50 overs in 2011 World Cup. I mean, he wasn't, because Ian Harvey was like decades before him, right? And Steve, if you want to really go back, Steve Waugh bowled a lot of slower balls in the death. In fact, the 1987 Australian team really did it. So it had been done before Zahir Khan. But, you know, he certainly... you say here, was there anyone else who before him bowled as many slow balls? I mean, Adam Holyoake clearly bowled a ton more slow balls than Zahir Khan ever did. And Ian Harvey probably the same. So there had been bowlers like that before. And Simon O'Donnell, Steve Waugh, probably not quite as much. But if you look at some of the old clips of them, they were bowling them a lot as well. Don't count the Aussies in 1987. They used off cutters for a different purpose. No. Steve Waugh and Simon O'Donnell use back of the hand slow balls, so they aren't off cutters. But Ian Harvey certainly bowled a lot more slow balls. Depending on how you feel about Chris Harris, he was bowling a lot more slow balls. Adam Holyoake, certainly another one. There's a couple of others that I can't quite think of at the moment. But Santoki, is that his name? The West Indian bowler come through. I think he was before 2011, wasn't he? So yeah, there was certainly a lot that bowled them before him. And there were bowlers who bowled them at the death quite a lot. What is his legacy? I'm not sure he has a massive legacy in T20 cricket. He probably helped popularise the knuckleball. But to be fair, it was really Andrew Tye that took it to another level. And that was a long time after Zahir Khan. And I don't think Andrew Tye necessarily got it from Zahir Khan. But at the same time, you know, Adam Holyoake bowling the knuckleball didn't really change anything all that much when he was bowling them. And he didn't bowl them all that much either at that point. So coming through to Zahir Khan, he's probably one of the next major proponents of bowling that particular delivery. But again, I'm not sure he has that bigger impact on T20 cricket, because a lot of these guys, it's like... So we call Saqlain Mushtaq the inventor of the Dusra. It's just not true, right? Because the Dusra actually existed before Saqlain Mushtaq. Not the name, but the delivery. We know there was a guy called Jack Potter who bowled it in playing for Victoria in the 1960s, and Richie Benaud begged him to take his bowling more seriously, and he was a batter. We know the same with the wrongen. There were many leg spinners who bowled a wrongen before Bosie did. The difference is that Bosie actually knew what he was doing, and the others probably did it more by accident and couldn't control it. Reverse sweep with the Muhammad brothers. Again, reverse sweep had been played before them. They were probably the first to really do it. And so Zahir Khan is another player in that sort of, like, do we call Zahir Khan a knuckleball bowler? By modern standards, he's probably not, right? He didn't bowl the knuckleball in the same way that, say, Simon O'Donnell bowled the back of the hand slow ball. So it was very, very different from that perspective. I don't think Zahir Khan has a huge amount of legacy in T20 cricket. Rem Kumar says, is Yuzvendra Chahal's lack of batting and extremely poor fielding hurt his chances of playing for India in the World Cups? I've said this a lot with him. They have two left-arm finger spinners who can bat and field. They all three of those players spin the ball in the same direction. They went in with Jadeja and Akshar at times and couldn't even fit both of them in the side. How are they going to have Yuvi in the side, right? It's sad for him, but it's just one of those things. You know, I think we might have talked about this on Wagon Wheel the other day. On Uncovered the other day, or Overthrows, or one of the scoreboards. Someone was asking a similar question, but there's a reason why Zampa and Agar don't always play together, right? There's a reason why Tahir and Watt don't always play together for Scotland. Sometimes you just end up with this unfortunate overlap of skills when it comes to international cricket, and there isn't a lot you can do about that. Kuldeep is the better match, right? For Kuldeep or Ashwin is the better match for Akshar or Jadeja than Chahal is now, but Chahal might be the best spinner out of all of them, But he got, you know, it's not, it is about batting and it is about fielding and it is about everything. And, you know, it, if you've got Kuldeep, who can spin the ball the other way to those two I just mentioned, and no one's saying he's a huge plus on batting or fielding in T20 cricket, right? Test cricket, and obviously at least hold a bat, but certainly not in T20 cricket. But he spins the ball the other way, and he still has striking capability in the same way that Chahal does. So if you want to use Akshar, if you want to use Jadeja, you know, whatever your middle sort of is for India there, you then have a guy who spins it the other way, and it's much better, right? Ashwin. You then have a finger spinner, maybe slightly more defensive, but a very smart cricketer will give you experience in other ways and can hold a bat and will help with strategy. They're all offering multiple options that Chahal doesn't. But realistically, if you want to know the main reason, I think he spins it in the wrong direction because of those other two guys. Ram Kumar says, what are the sites to mine T20 data? Cricksheet.org is the best place to find your data. And what's the other one? I don't know if it's mining, but is it Crickmetric? Is really cool. And then Himanish has put out Himanish Ganju. If you go to his Twitter account, I'm hoping he's linked the website where he's got bunches of information as well, which is absolutely fantastic. Some advanced stats there as well. So those are the three main ones that I'm aware of. Ben says, now their time is almost certainly over. Where do Bairstow and Roy rank in the terms of ODI opening partnerships? So I can't remember if we ended up doing this in the World Cup. I don't think we did, actually. But it was something that, you know, we were thinking about coming in. I mean, it's hard because I think if you look at them on pure records, they probably look like the greatest of all time. And that's more than fair because they were absolutely fantastic. The issue with that, of course, is that... you've got a situation that there where every generation, like the next generation of openers, might look better than them just because their strike rates are going to go even higher. And you know, on top of that, the way that England played and everything else, you would have to look at it from a, you know, sort of true economy and true average sort of section. They might still come out as best if we're being honest, but you'd have to be a little bit more fair, I think. When having a look at that. But it is that there's absolutely no doubt that, you know, the ability to make, you know, the ability to score runs, it's just phenomenal what they did at the pace that they did it at. So if you have a look, so I'll just bring it up here. There have been 61 partnerships that have scored over 1,000 runs opening the batting in one day international cricket, right? And of those, the highest average is Travis Head and David Warner, 75. That's pretty good. So you got Rohit Sharma and Shubman Gill, and they are at 72. And so Bairstow and Roy come in as the fifth best in terms of average. But of those, and that's 58, right? But they have scored over... almost 3,000 runs, so over 2,000 runs. So the next best of the big scorers in terms of average is Greenidge and Haynes, who's over 5,000 runs, and they're at over 50. And then the next best then is Ganguly and Tendulkar, who's at 49, and they're over 6,000 runs. So straight away, you're just like, well, they're already automatically near the top of that when you look at, you know, huge amount of runs. Now, if you look at partnership run rate, so Warner and Head might be at the top of this one again. Warner and Head score at 7.5 runs and over. Sharma and Shubman are at 7 runs and over, and Roy are at 6.88. So it does it, what I just said is exactly what's already happened. There's already been two partnerships that have scored quicker than Bairstow and Roy, but and with a better average, but over a much smaller sample size. And do Rohit and Gill and Head and Warner play the way they do without, you know, the Bairstow Roy side of things? So, you know, there's a few different things to have a look at there. But I think if you're looking at over 2,000 runs, over an average of 50 and over a run of ball, my guess is you're looking at a club of one, right? So, well, actually, Sehwag and Tendulkar. Oh, Sehwag and Tendulkar. No, they average less than 50. Yeah. I'm just having a quick look to see if anyone else gets in. Or Gilchrist and Hayden just miss out on average and runs per over. So, I mean, that tells you that is a special partnership. So I think there's a couple of Tendulkar partnerships. There's Gilchrist and Hayden. There's some of the modern ones might go on to be fantastic, although I think with Warner and Rohit aging out, that might change a little bit. And then you've got Greenidge and Haynes. And I don't know. I'm trying to see what the highest Sanjay Saria one is here because I can't see him. Jay Saria and Taranga. Yeah, he doesn't. Him and Kalu were at 5.2 runs and over. Yeah, I don't really have any great Jay Saria ones, but obviously you might Jay Saria plus other human probably has a say, but maybe doesn't quite make it in the same way. Let's have a quick break here on Wagon Wheel, and we'll come back in a moment with more of your questions. This is brought to you by Cricket 8. They are a new player in the game trying to educate fans on what is really happening in cricket. We have a partnership with them where we host live watch-alongs, do podcasts and write articles. If you want to know what is really happening with our game, visit cricket8.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit truegreen.com, TRUGREEN.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Wagon Wheel. Oh, I got the right one here. Aditya says, the latest Cricket Picks episode is about the ultimate T20 attack. It was really good. Do you think that Kuldeep and Chahal deserve a place in the discussion when it comes to the best T20 spinners? I mean, Kuldeep isn't there yet. You know, some of these T20 spinners have just incredible records. And Kuldeep was dropped not that long ago, right? Like, you know, he couldn't get into his side. And his economy is maybe a little bit higher than some of those other guys. But he's, you know, a fantastic bowler. I think Chahal is going to be a really interesting one because he's probably not going to end up now with too much more international cricket. What is he, 33, 34 years old maybe? His T20 record is what, 342 wickets at 23? Again, 7.5 runs and over. So I don't know if he's elite in that way that, you know, Narayan and Rashid Khan and, you know, Samuel Badri were and Shahid Afridi and those sorts of guys. But these are, you know, not that far off, and Kuldeep could still make that. Maybe Chahal is just a level below that kind of bowler, but not far away at all. But he's a fantastic bowler. I think he's massively underrated by most fans. James says, Billy Birmingham's The 12th Man Comedy Album Series ever find... Did it ever find any kind of audience in Asia? Do you or other listeners know if there was an Asian comedian with similar cricket-related act? Don't know if there was anyone with a similar act of any kind to Billy Birmingham's. It was, thinking back to it, such a remarkable kind of one-man show. That might be something for people in the comments to say whether they know of Billy Birmingham, although people on YouTube would be maybe too young to be able to tell that. My memory of it was more big in England and Australia, got a little bit in New Zealand and South Africa as well. But yeah, I don't remember as many of my Asian friends talking about it. Whereas, you know, there are still a lot of English people and New Zealand people will occasionally bring it up. So for those who don't know, Billy Birmingham basically made radio plays, but on CD, or in Kazette originally, about like fantasy worlds of the Channel 9 commentary team. It just shows you how famous the Channel 9 commentary team were that this worked. He released a song and the song went to like number one. It charted. I think it went to number one, but it certainly charted. And the whole song was Richie Beno singing Everything's Marvelous. A lot of the things we now remember as Channel 9 kind of things, we remember because Billy Birmingham made a big deal out of them. There's a lot of like casual racism all the way through and outright racism and lots of like toilet humor and all sorts of things. And it was weird. It was a weird world that it lived in, sort of 80s, early 90s Australia. And even by the late 90s, people were a little bit like, you know, how is this still around? But yeah, it was, I don't know of any other, of anyone in Asia doing anything similar or anyone anywhere doing anything similar. It's, you know, I've seen Asian stand-up comedians do Harsha Bhogle impressions and Ravi Shastri impressions and, you know, talk about cricket a fair bit. I went to a couple of comedy shows in Chennai a couple of years ago, and there was like lots of jokes about cricket commentary and cricketers in general and Virat Kohli and Emma Stoney and these sorts of things, but not anything like Billy Birmingham, because what Billy Birmingham did was kind of the next level, right? It wasn't just doing a couple of jokes in your set about cricket. It was legitimately basing an entire fantasy world on a commentary box. I mean, I can't imagine there are many times that's ever happened in sport. Satchmo says, would you downgrade a fast bowler's greatness if they never bowled around the wicket? For example, Michael Holding expressed a reservation that Curly Ambrose in the book Real Quick in 1995. Conversely, what if they bowled around the wicket excessively? No. No, because that's... what you're not talking about their greatness there. You're talking about their utility, right? In the days when... bowlers didn't bowl around the wicket all that much, it wasn't even a thought process. So there are many bowlers who probably almost never bowled around the wicket to left-handers, let alone all to right-handers at any time, just because it wasn't something that you did. So why would I downgrade them for something that wasn't common at that time, right? Like it would be a silly thing to downgrade them for because they didn't know, right? It would be like downgrading bowlers because they didn't bowl slow balls. Like Joel Garner's not as good as Glenn McGrath because he didn't bowl slow balls. It's like, if Joel Garner had known how good slow balls would have been, he would have chucked a couple of slow balls in, all right? And he probably would have been even better. So you can't downgrade people for that. But on top of that, like, let's say I'm trying to think of someone more specific. Let's say Richard Hadlee never bowled around the wicket, right? And I never saw him bowl around the wicket. Doesn't mean he didn't. But let's say he never ever bowled around the wicket to left-handers or to right-handers in any situation at any time. Look at his record. It's still absolutely fantastic. There might be some games where he didn't get wickets when he should have, but there might have been other times when he worked out his way of doing it over the wicket. Like, I don't see the argument for that when Richard Hadlee played, it wasn't a common thing for bowlers to do. So I'm not quite sure what your question there is, Satchmo. Weirdly, I don't know if it was you, Satchmo, or someone else. Someone keeps asking me about around the wicket and Michael Holding and all this stuff. And I'm like, just wasn't a thing during their era. William says, where did it go wrong for Sam Curran's death bowling? Where did it go right? Like one time. Like I think people have misremembered everything else that Sam Curran had ever done. He's never been a plus T20 bowler. He had one World Cup where it all worked fantastically well, way better than like anyone would have believed, right? But year on year, Sam Curran is not a great death bowler and has never been, and he's not even been a consistent death bowler. It's not even been his job. England knew that they were struggling for death bowlers, and I think what they did in that situation is they gave him a very, very clear plan. And they said, this is what we would like you to be able to do, right? He comes to Australia, there are bigger boundaries, and he bowls absolutely fantastic, right? No one's got any issues with that. But let's have a look at year-on-year Sam Curran death bowling. So in 2015, he averaged almost 30 in the death when he bowled as a kid, 8.5, not too bad economy, right? All of these are on low usage. He averaged 27, 31, 37, 33, 37, 41, 29, 27, 39, 45. Those are his averages in the last four overs. He has had some years with very, very good economies. But generally, those are years when he's only bowled low amounts of balls, right? And if you look at the years where he starts to bowl more balls, almost every time he goes up to either what you would expect the rate to be or above the rate. The best year is 2022, of course, where he did actually manage to take wickets as well, but he had an economy of 7.2. And the only other year I would say where he was okay is probably 2020 with high usage. There's a year where he averages six at the death, but he only bowls 100 balls. So he's a one-dimensional defensive death bowler who can go around average economy at his absolute best, but he doesn't get you any wickets at all, right? So the average at the death is probably around, in his period, is probably around 18 to 16, and he's averaging 40 and 50 some years, right? So he doesn't get you any wickets. And so what you get with Sam Curran is quite often a situation where he will bowl some of the early, easier death overs, and then he starts to really struggle quite often when it gets to the end. And that's what you would expect from an all-rounder. In fact, that's almost like, I almost think that's the perfect situation for him, is that ability to bowl early death overs. That I'm trying to think, like a Harshal Patel type, what Harshal Patel probably should have been, right? So if you look at, where have we got here? Yeah. So his economy rate, in the 15th over is, something's gone wrong here. His economy rate in the 15th over is 9.27. His economy rate in the 16th over is 9.6. His economy rate in the 18th over is 9.19. 17th over, 8.89, then 9.9. And it goes up. That's absolutely exactly what you would expect. If you give him those earlier death overs, he doesn't have too much of an issue at all. But he doesn't get wickets in those periods because he's not particularly incisive. So you are getting, probably looking at his numbers here, slightly above average runs per over, and you're not getting any wickets. And then on the back end of that, he's getting you wickets. You're hoping, that you're getting wickets early on. But yeah, you look at his overall figures, and when he's suddenly become a high-usage death bowler, which had never happened until 2022, he had one really good year, and then he got absolutely panned the next year. So what does that tell you? Beforehand, he was probably bowling against inferior opposition. He was probably bowling with better death bowlers around him. He probably didn't have to bowl a lot of death overs back to back to back. And now that he's having to bowl a lot, suddenly he's going for a ton. So he bowled in 2023, 800 death balls. And I reckon his first 5 years, he doesn't bowl that many. Oh, actually, no, he might have bowled slightly more than that combined. And even then, he had some pretty bad years. Yeah, I think that he's, because he did well, there's sort of a misremembering of who he is. He's still learning it, and that's absolutely fine. But let's not expect him to be great at it because he doesn't have a lot of the weapons that you need.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow. Today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Bloody says, which batter looked the most elegant, beautiful to you compared to how the actual average was or how bad they were? That's a very interesting question. I think someone in the comments put James Vince and Kagiso Rabada, which are very, very fair. I mean, there are some tail enders. I mean, Rabada is a very good example of this, of a tail ender who looks very elegant and then never makes any runs at all. So I suppose that one would make sense. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. I mean, Hick is probably another one, certainly in Test cricket, that you would say, I'm not sure if he looked as elegant as Vince. I'm trying to think if there must be someone from somewhere else. It would have to be a West Indian who just looked incredible and ended up with no runs. Keith Arterton was certainly someone who, when you watched him, had an incredible style to him. And I don't know if I ever saw him make any runs. So he comes to mind from the West Indies. I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. But Vince is a very good shout on that one. Ellie says, how do you see the development of T20 World Cup being held in the USA? Is USA going to be a summer UAE neutral host with big diaspora population? Look, I mean, there's a few different ways that the USA can be successful. One is that local fans start to turn up. Another one is that the investment that they can manage to get from over there is so much higher than anywhere else, so they can set up a proper infrastructure. You have the ability to be a neutral venue, or as you say, that sort of. So many places in the world can host cricket between October and February, right? A place that can host cricket in that other part of the year could be really interesting from an international point of view, but also from a franchise level. I think there's a few different ways it can go, but I have absolutely no idea how it will go. I mean, USA cricket is still run terribly. Right. We did a podcast on one of their tournaments recently that clearly should not have gone ahead and should not have been sanctioned. And they still, I don't know what's happening with the World Cup, but the more I hear about it, the worse it seems to get. So yeah, there's not a part of me that's sitting here going, it's all going to be a massive success. Rudra says, what sort of variety in pitches have you seen in the USA? I am really only aware of the Florida ones, going from incredibly slow to low to incredibly flat. Is there any way for us to know how the New York pitches will turn out? I don't know anything about New York. I haven't gone through the schedule, and it wouldn't be that hard. You would just go through the schedule and have a look at the stats from the wickets, Rudra, but I haven't gone through them yet. I'll probably go through them before the World Cup. New York, I don't know if we'll ever know that much. It'll probably just be hearsay in the grounds. Curator and everyone will say something along the lines of, I think it will do this, and we'll have to wait and see. But I didn't watch a massive amount of the Major League Cricket in the end. I've probably seen more minor league cricket than I've seen Major League Cricket, and that's not really helping us for this question. Swami Nathan says, I noticed that the Wisden's Five Cricketers of the Year has too many obscure English first-class cricketers who get picked along with obvious great internationals. What would the rationale be behind having them side-by-side international cricket that has superseded first-class cricket by miles? Because it's not an international award. It never has been. Wisden's Five Cricketers of the Year was around before there was international cricket. And also, Wisden's Five Cricketers of the Year is for the English summer. I think so many people have no idea what Wisden. There's so many weird things about it. One is you can't win it twice, right? So it stops Jimmy Anderson getting it 12 years in a row. So it means that there has to be a wider pool. You have to have played in the English summer to get in it. And that, so think about what you're saying, Swami Nathan. That might be five test matches, right? And if that's the case, might be that there weren't that many fantastic players in those test matches, right? They didn't play all that well. So it started as an English summer award, and it still is an English summer award. And I think a lot of people get frustrated and angry with it, but no one ever looks up what the regulations are on it. That's why they brought in the International Cricketer of the Year and some of the other awards, because they realized how out of date it was. It's supposed to be for the English summer, and there will be some fantastic players who played incredibly in county cricket that deserve to be in the five players of the year at times, because that's what the award is for. Sachmo said, should India play Kuldeep and or Ashwin and a maximum of three seamers in every away test, not just in Asia? I don't think they'll play Kuldeep and Ashwin together all that much outside of Asia, because they both spin the ball in the same direction. So my guess is that they will probably try and play Cool Deep and Didasia together. Also, if you play Cool Deep and Ashwin together, you're missing out on more batting and you're missing out on Didasia as a player. So I would assume if you're going to see lineups like that, well, Cool Deep and Didasia will be the way to go. Christopher says, what's some of your favorite ever cricket scorecards? Can be for weird patterns, peculiar innings. Oh, I should know this. There is a game, I want to say in the 1930s, where I know Warwickshire is involved, but I think they're the bowling team, and they bowl out, I want to say Hampshire, for 15 runs, and then forced to follow on and lose. That's one off the top of my head. There's obviously the game where the where a subfielder from the opposition or from the home team went out and took a catch, which I think I might have covered on something, but we're trying to do a special on that soon. So he took a catch against his own team in a first class game and made a 50. So I think he's the only person who's ever made a 50 and taken a catch in the same innings. I do love a lot of the old bowling scorecards where it's just two bowlers and that's just it. And sometimes you'll see like two bowlers used for a whole game. I think Spofforth and Boyle, that might've been how Test cricket was kind of born. Well, certainly Test cricket in England, was that Spofforth and Boyle, I think, were the only two bowlers used in a whole game against the MCC for Australia and took the, obviously, is it 11 and 9? I'm trying to remember the numbers, but it looks incredible. There's a mean dad innings. I want to say he makes 200 out of like, not like 260 or something, which is absolutely remarkable. Yeah, I mean, those are the ones. I do like a good, I like it when you're looking at the scorecard and you can't tell how many people have bowled because so many people have bowled. Always enjoying that. Always enjoy that as well. But yeah, those are the ones off the top of my head that make sense. And, you know, occasionally you see that sort of the top order don't make any runs and then number 9, 10 and 11 make runs or number 10 and 11 make runs. That always looks good if you've got a bunch, you've got single figures all the way up. Some of those old wet wickets were like that, where it's just like impossible for your top order to make runs. And then the wicket sort of evens out and the tail just knock it around a little bit because the ball's now all wet and soft. And so the bowling team no longer has an advantage. Vickers says, RCB management suck. It's not that they don't hire good coaches. They're Mike Hessen and now they have Andy Flower and your friend Freddie working with them for some time as well. Green transferred when they already had Roy for 3. Yeah. Playing Elzari when they have Topley, who is really good for some time. I mean, it's funny because if obviously I had 3 or 4 days of experience working around that camp. Not that I spent a lot of time with the management directly, but it was really, really clear when I was there that there were too many people making decisions that ultimately Virat had to get on board with. And when I was there, the running joke was Virat was the businessman in the world. So how do you get him on to your decision if you can't get him into a meeting? He didn't meet all the analysts, for instance, the year that I was briefly involved. I wasn't an analyst, so I wasn't one of the people who didn't meet him, but he didn't meet all the analysts. And it's like, well, straight away, you're creating a, you know, if you're the captain and you're not hearing the information freshly. There were lots of divisions when I was involved. They had two internal analysts that from competing, they were kind of competing with each other because one was an outside analyst that the coaching staff had brought in and the other one was the, was it Diageo? Was an analyst brought in by Diageo, if that's what they called. And it's like they had completely different ways of working and different ways of thinking about things and it didn't really make sense. It just felt to me really, really disorganized. And it's funny, like with Virat, I've always felt that when it came to India, he put kind of everything in he could to organize everything correctly and get it where he wanted. And I feel like in the IPL, he's so busy and stretched out that he hasn't ever had the opportunity to do that. And when he's been in charge of the Indian team, it's been him and another strong individual at the top having conversations. And I feel that too many times at RCB, that was not the case. And he was the person who ultimately went to, and he was making decisions more based on, you know, kind of vibes. And so I think that was a problem. And I'm not even sure he always wanted to be the person who made those decisions, right? But it defaulted to him because of who he was. So there was a real sort of hero worship, I thought, around him at times. I think also Virat has a more old-fashioned view on T20 cricket. And then you've got the sort of the outsiders. So like Vettori, for instance, I think Vettori really wanted to change the culture and do things very, very differently when he was at RCB. But ultimately, I'm not sure at that stage in his career as a coach, he was the greatest communicator to get that across. And I felt that you had, I think they had Ashish Neera, Trent Woodhill, Virat Kohli, Dan Vettori, all there. Woodhill and Vettori were very much together, but Kohli and Neera were very much together. And there was overflow between those things, but they were almost four different islands. And I always felt that the communication and the professionalism wasn't the way that they all thought it was that it needed to work. So that's my time of being there, right? That's a lot of messiness. You've got two different analyst camps. You've got, you know, completely different thought patterns. And then you've got this sort of deferring to one person to make him happy when I'm not even sure that, I say this honestly, I have no idea if Virat actually wants to run that franchise. And obviously now he's not even in charge, but whether he wants to run it or not. But I still feel that decisions are made to defer to him, even if that's not the case. And so, you know, from the outside, it looked messy. And from the inside, it looked like there were too many people who were worried about their jobs, who were worried about pleasing Virat, and no one really took the reins. That's my opinion. And it could be completely wrong. And that was only over a 2-year period of being around that franchise and talking to people and everything else. And things have changed a lot since then. But the same problems keep happening, right? Feels like they want to put as many great batters around Virat as possible. And because of that, we don't see fully functioning 11s from them all that often. And they keep making little mistakes. Like they had Moeen Ali and didn't use him effectively at all. So I don't know. I don't actually know how to answer that. Hopefully I got that right. Ben says, what was with all the endless Bazball fails type articles and fan comments after England officially lost the Test series? Were people expecting it to make a mid-table team beat the cricketing superpower at home? It's not a cheat code. It is simply has made a really rubbish team perform better than rubbish. Is that not enough of a positive thing? I mean, it's what I kept saying, Ben, but I think the worst thing that happened to Bazball was the fact that they won so many tests on the bounce, right? They had that one loss against South Africa. Weirdly enough, if they had lost that other test to South Africa, if Dean Elgar got the toss right, they could have easily lost that other test. And then everyone would have thought so differently about Bazball, but it got hyped up so much, and especially after what happened in Pakistan. But you're right. I mean, that's what I was saying the whole time. The idea of Bazball is really to maximize your team's potential of winning. And I think that there's a natural fear, hatred of England because of colonial things, because of cricket things that we've always had. And, you know, there was a lot of people reacting to the hype around Bazball as well. The players probably made it worse for themselves, Ben, by going on about saving cricket and all this sort of nonsense. But yes, on the very basis of it, from the start, I said that's what it was. It was the ability to turn a very flawed team into a consistent threat. That's what we saw. The fact that they went to India and won a test match, the fact that they were in a position to win any other test matches is because they had completely changed their side and the way that they thought about cricket and the way that they went after it. It's also meant that they've lost games that they should have won. So it goes both ways. It was never a magic fix-all. You know, when the West Indies and Australia went into their styles. So look at the West Indies. The West Indies basically went, we're picking spinners and all of our best bowlers are seam bowlers. Let's just pick the seam bowlers, right? They still had a great batting lineup. What they didn't have was the ability to consistently take wickets. They made a way to consistently take wickets. Their bowlers took over. Australia was winning a lot, but drawing test matches and series that they thought they should have won. And they were like, okay, so we just need to tweak this to make sure that there are more results. And they did that, and that's what they did. Those are two teams fine-tuning something that, you know, with really strong bases. West Indies should have been better than they were in that mid-70s period. Australia were already the best team in the world and then got even better. England were doing it from the basement, right? And I think people forgot that. Have a look at all the questions on Ben from all the scoreboards we did. It was the same question over and over again. Why did everyone say this was going to work? It's not working. It's like, it's already worked, right? It took a really poor team and made them better. Ian says, long before T20 existed, local league cricket used to play 120 balls in the form of 15 8-ball overs for midweek evening games. I know it won't happen, but hypothetically, what do you think would be the main differences and what type of players would benefit or not if this came to professional cricket compared to conventional T20? Yeah, it's one of these things. Someone put a message up on one of our TikTok videos going, well, Martin Crowe invented T20 cricket. It's like, no one really invented T20 cricket, right? I played 20 over cricket. I played under 10s and under 12s, right? Like, it was a normal form of cricket. There were heaps of midweek competitions around the world that would play 20 over cricket, right? Because you couldn't always fit in a proper game. It's very regular, to be able to be done. This is interesting though. So the eight ball overs, of course, is an Australian thing. Eight ball overs, I think, makes more sense for cricket. And the reason that we don't have eight ball overs is probably ads, right? When it comes down to it, you can't fit as many ads into cricket. But it makes more sense. It would speed up the game. And there is, from a cricket perspective, I can't imagine why you would not want eight ball overs over six ball overs. What they would do is, I would assume, Ian, it would help spinners a little bit more, and it would probably hurt genuine fast bowlers a little bit more, would be my guess. But I am only guessing on that. That would be the main difference. And you might get truly great bowlers have the ability to keep a bad batter on strike a little bit longer. Those would be the things. But yeah, I still, you know, for all the talk about how we can fix over rates and everything, it's like, can we make overs longer? Because they have been. I think they've been, what, four balls, five balls, six balls, eight balls. I think seven's the only one that I don't think we used in cricket, if I can remember correctly. And I do think eight balls probably makes the most sense. You could even argue 10 balls makes the most sense. You know, one of the biggest problems is cricket is the amount of times that we stop and change ends. We don't need to do that. All right. I know the IPL game's on, so I should nick off and do that in a minute. But I'll just take a quick ad here. And then after the ad, we'll come back with any questions from the room. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Varun has just said, I think he's talking about Besto and Roy here. He says, even adjusted, I've got them as the best opening partnership. So I don't know how far that goes back, but I think that would make sense. If you look at amount of runs, average, and strike rate, I would have thought that they were the best ODI partnership for that. But then it does get down to how, you know, what did I say it was? Almost 3,000 runs. How does that compare to some of these other partnerships at 5,000 runs that were also probably not that far away when it comes to adjusted average and strike rate and everything else. Where else are we here? How do you rate Stoinis in T20 cricket? Why do you think he never reached Pollard and Russell levels? He always had the power game. He's nowhere near that kind of player role. He's not as talented as those guys, but also they are middle order players who have always been middle order players, whereas Stoinis isn't really a lower order player. He had to learn that. He's probably, his best role would still be opening the batting. His best role really would be a guy just punching through the line, opening the batting, chipping the ball over the top of the field for four over and over again. In the middle, he's done fantastic to be able to learn that, but you know, he's nowhere near the level of a batter that Pollard or Russell are. He also kept pushing himself in first class cricket when those guys specialized, you know, and so they specialized in their positions, in their format. And he spent years playing multi-format cricket and playing as an opener, playing as a first drop, playing as a middle order player. It just took him longer. But I don't think he's as consistent at hitting the balls, those two people. Harsh says, Jared, ECB, BCI and Cricket Australia in talks of being back in the Champions League. Scheduling is the main issue. Your thoughts on it? Okay, so there's a bunch of huge problems about it, right? I think it would be my favourite tournament if it existed outside of World Cups. Where it goes, you're going to have to get rid of an ICC tournament, which means that the ICC are going to have to succeed some positioning. That's where they make all their money, so they're probably not going to want to do that. So that's going to be tricky, but if it is the three biggest sports, possible. But the biggest issue is, and has always been, when Victoria qualified for the Champions League, Dirk Nannis, Cameron White, Brad Hodge, all qualified for multiple teams. So who are you going to pick? You're always going to go with the IPL teams, right? Because they're going to pay you more. So until the 100 or the Big Bash, and neither of them are ever, well, certainly the Big Bash is never going to pay anywhere near what the IPL is. And the 100 probably won't, the way it's being developed at the moment. So it just means that every player who's gone through the IPL, so it's going to be a team of IPL players up against a team of players who aren't in the IPL over and over again. It doesn't mean that those other teams won't occasionally win. We even had some wins early on. You know, we talked about the Champions League a couple of weeks ago with a similar question. But it's not like football. In football, you play for one team. And if your team doesn't make the finals, doesn't make the Champions League, you have to transfer to another team. Dwayne Bravo could qualify for 7 teams in a year. Dan Christian could qualify for 15 teams in a year. It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense. I think that's the biggest issue. But the reason it failed the first time wasn't even that. It was that no one watched the other teams play, right? They only cared about the IPL teams. And unless you can make it so that people from around the world really care about it, why would you care about it if you're, I don't know, an SA20 fan, right? And your best players all go off to play for their IPL franchise and you're an SA20 team anyway. And you're already a feeder team. Like, I don't see why you would care all that much about your franchise playing. And so what about if you're a 100 team? Let's say you're the Oval Invincibles, right? And you've got Sunil Narine and your team. And then Kolkata make it. And you lose Sunil Narine. What? How does that work? What? I fundamentally don't understand how it's going to work. I hope it does. Because I always said that I was more excited about that than the IPL. But people didn't care about it. I was one of about 7 people that cared about that competition. Shrina says, will we see subs being introduced to international cricket soon? Well, we've had them before, of course, with the super sub rule. I do think we will eventually see subs. Soon, I don't know, Shrina. But I just don't think we can keep going with the amount of injuries and pretending that subs wouldn't be able to fix all these problems. How will it affect the dynamics? I've done entire articles about this. I couldn't go into it here. But essentially, it would allow for cricket to be the best batters up against the best bowlers all the time. And I think that would be a fantastic way of going about it. As Frat Boy says, what is the greatest cricket commentary moment in your mind? Steve Waugh, last ball, 100, Carlos Brathwaite, Kohli out of the ground, agony for New Zealand, something else. Mike Gatting has absolutely no idea what's happened to him. Still doesn't know. Don't know what it is. It's Richie Beno. It's very bad Richie Beno. I don't have a good Richie Beno. Richie Beno, Shane Warne. There's that moment where Mike Gatting has been bowled by that incredible delivery, first ball in England by Shane Warne, and Gatting is looking around, trying to work out if he's been stumped, trying to work out if Ian Healy's knocked the bails off, and Richie Beno just nails it. That whole commentary is absolutely brilliant from top to bottom, actually. Tom says, is Josh Butler in decline or in a slump? I'd probably say he's in a slump. The question there about him going back to being a finisher, I think is very, very interesting, Tom. I would lean towards slump. If he goes back to being a finisher, that's probably where he's going to end his career. And if he starts making runs, are they going to stuff with him anyway and move him back up the top? But yes, he just doesn't look like he's moving as well as he used to for me. So I think with that in mind, he's I wouldn't throw him out or anything. And he's the sort of player that once he gets back on top is absolutely fantastic. But I do think for a little while, I just want to have a look at his overall numbers. I do think for a little while, he just hasn't looked, I think sharp is the word I would use. And I don't know if it's injury. I don't know if it's technical. I think he's always had a chance of being dismissed early in with the new ball. And it was one reason I was a little bit, so, you know, when I worked against him as an analyst, my whole thing was put as many slips in as you can because he will find them. Let's just have a look at his numbers. So in 2022, he averaged 46 with a strike rate of 152 in all T20. Last year, it was 35 at 141. I mean, 35 at 141 is still a plus, but it's a big step down from 46 at 152. And this year, it's 34 at 136. He's probably getting on, so it could just be that he's aging out a little bit as well. I'm trying to think, when was the last year he struck at 136 in T20 cricket? It would be 2017. That's the only time he's got a strike rate of this. 2012 is the next one. So it's possible that we're just seeing, age doesn't rob you of your peaks, but it does rob you of your consistency. And you look at those numbers, and you look at his average, and he was averaging, 44 and 46, and now he's averaging 35 and 34. This could just be, a natural aging decline. He's such a good athlete, though. I kind of feel like it's probably more likely a slump, but either of those things are possible. But I have always thought that there are ways to get him out with the new ball, which is why I would have always felt more comfortable with him batting down the order, because I never really saw him with any flaws down the order. But I also understand the opposite of he became one of the world's best opening batters, and so you want him to face more balls. It's just not the way that I would use Josh Butler. I kind of think Josh Butler is like that Heinrich Klassen, David Miller, Kyron Pollard level middle overs batter. And you can get another opener to average 35 or 40 with a strike rate of 130, 135. And then you have one of the world's best finishers. But it just depends on how you look at these things. Everyone's different. Anyway, that is it for me for today. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel. Thank you very much for everyone for your support. Thank you to Cricket 8 for their partnership. Go over to cricket8.com. We'll be doing watch-alongs this weekend on Saturday and Sunday. But I'm off to watch along with the IPL game, which I've already missed the first 27 minutes off. But thank you for being here if you were here live, and thank you for listening along. Go to goodareas.co to follow all of our writing. We've done some really fascinating stuff with sort of the history of IPL, but there's also some other things that are coming up as well. But I am Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel. We'll see you again very soon. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.